So, yeah, shall we jump straight in with a bit of personal background, just what you were doing prior to the Ebola outbreak and how you got initially involved, I guess?
So my official title at CDC is Associate Director for Communication Science. Typically, I work in environmental health. However, I have done a substantial amount of emergency response and international emergency response incorporating risk communication. Mm-hmm. So I was asked to go to Liberia because one of the people who was over there thought that the country could benefit from a risk communication approach.
Mm-hmm. So that was someone from the CDC?
Yes.
Okay. So at what point did you arrive then?
I arrived early in September of 2014. Mm-hmm. Was there for about 5 or 6 weeks. I came home for 30 days and went back in middle November of 2014, stayed until right before Christmas, and then was home working on the response domestically. In between deployments, I was working in our joint information center, and then I returned to Liberia in July and August of 2015.
Okay, well, that's great, because I think you have probably a nice perspective on how the whole story evolved throughout those three periods, because they were quite different just in terms of the challenges, I guess, that they presented. So if we go back to September, which was really the peak of the crisis, what did you find from a communications, social mobilization side, just when you arrived? What were some of the first things that struck you as serious challenges?
One of the largest challenges was that the country had, although it had a very skilled and able social mobilization group and approach, they were overwhelmed by mm-hmm. the size, not only of the epidemic itself, but also of the international response.
Right.
And not having previously had such a an event in Liberia, there was no structure for international agencies to intersect with the Ministry of Health in the health promotion discipline or arena.
Mm-hmm.
At the same time, Liberia is a very relationship intensive society. Relationships are extremely important. So it just wouldn't have been appropriate nor suitable for CDC to charge in and say, here's what mm-hmm. we need to do. So it took about 3 weeks of listening and watching and gathering information to be able to propose an alternative. So that was one of the major challenges.
Mm-hmm.
What was going on at the time was that by the middle of September, there were 60 NGOs in Liberia working on 250 different projects.
Wow.
The country had no mapping of where those NGOs were, and the social mobilization meetings were basically committees of the whole with about 50 to 60 different organizations represented, all with extensive response experience, all believing their way was worthy,
mm-hmm.
and all talking at the same time.
Hmm.
Then there was a message development group that was staffed by UNICEF, which did an extraordinary job. However, the message and materials development committee meetings tended to follow the same pattern.
Mm-hmm.
About 50 to 60 different organizations present, all talking at the same time.
Mm-hmm.
And so about 3 weeks into my engagement there, I proposed a structure to the Director of Health Promotion for the ministry that was adopted. In the meantime...
Was that Reverend Sumo? Was that Reverend Sumo?
Yes, sir.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. And then, in the meantime, we had been working with the IMS manager on some other issues, including an MMWR article that CDC was planning to publish
mm-hmm.
To be able to help them respond to that and bring a risk communication frame to that. And in the same time period, we established the partnership with AGI, which was an atypical partnership for CDC, and this addresses one of the other challenges. So first challenge is organization. Second challenge apologize for not being coherent.
No.
The second challenge was international communication and ensuring that the ministry had enough advance notification of what partners were doing that might have effect in the international arena that would have an impact on the Liberia response. The third challenge that we found was that messages were not making it out of the Message and Material Development Committee. They weren't making it out of the committee to the IMS structure and the partners, nor were they getting to the Ministry of Information and Cultural Affairs and Tourism, which is the official public communication agency for the Liberian government. So essentially we had to build a bridge between the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Information.
Right.
And AGI had someone assigned to the Ministry of Information. And so we worked together to put together what came to be called the Joint Communication Committee. And it was led by the Minister of Information and involved the public affairs officers of the major partners. Whereas the social mobilization leaders or the major partners were involved in the health promotion activity, we engaged the public affairs people in the Ministry of Information Joint Communication Council. And we also extended the minister extended the invitation to other branches of government that were involved with response. For example, the Ministry of Transportation communicated with taxi drivers who were providing ambulance service by default. So those other ministries were also invited, and we began to move information, health information, out of the Ministry of Health and across government and across the partners. And so I think the fourth item was ensuring that information moved. And so we did a couple of things. One, through the Joint Information Committee, restructuring the news conferences so that they would be a little more organized in terms of what the Ministry of Health could bring forward. And then also looking at instruments that the Ministry of Health could use to share with all partners so that everybody would have a common understanding of what was going on in the response. And all of that was risk communication based, because we were looking at the models of risk communication as well as cultural impacts. So those are probably the four biggest things in the first deployment.
Those are four big things. So if we want to maybe...
We also did an international risk communication, or national risk communication plan. Sorry, I forgot that. That was out of the Joint Communication Committee.
So the first issue that you mentioned about messages not... Well, basically just coordinating with those 60 NGOs and the government, the messaging committee, etc. What were some of the steps taken to fix that, essentially?
So what we did was to put in a sort of joint information center within the IMS structure. And if you're familiar with U.S. responses, a joint information center is typically a public affairs type activity, because the whole IMS structure derives from police and fire responses to emergency and the need to coordinate amongst local emergency responders. And that has since been elevated through FEMA and the Department of Homeland Security to a national paradigm. However, the communication paradigm, the Joint Information Center paradigm, continues to be pretty much a public information, public affairs approach. And so what we did was to adapt that to what worked for Liberia. And public affairs was not everything, because public affairs was really handled by the Ministry of Information. However, we needed a liaison with them.
Right.
The specific challenge was that in terms of span of control, Reverend Smoe had essentially 60 different organizations and all his staff reporting to him. And so his span of control was out of control. It was impossible for any individual to be able to do that. And so we needed, you know, in watching him try try to work with that. It seemed as though he needed a way that he could continue to get information and continue to manage the function, but also one that he could actually control.
Mm-hmm.
There was an opportunity also to provide development capability for his staff, which was relatively lean. They had about 6 people in the health promotion department. And then we needed to organize the international responders, because international responders are accustomed to coming into a system and working in a system, and Liberia did not have a system mm-hmm. in place for this magnitude of a response, or for an emergency response. They had good systems for regular activity like measles immunization, mm-hmm. maternal and child health. They did not have a system for emergency response. And so we looked at how we could build the Joint Information Center within the IMS structure. And so what we did was to basically look at what were the 4 things that were most needed in the country. And one was training. One was message and materials development. One was field mobilization and support,
mm-hmm.
and one was media to be able to link with the Ministry of Information.
Right.
And then we basically drew up terms of reference, invited, and I sat down with Reverend Simo. We agreed on the buckets. We agreed on people in his organization. He named the people in his organization who would be the ministry liaison with each of those work groups,
mm-hmm.
and then we established work groups to support that function that involved an international NGO and a national NGO to convene members of the work group.
Okay.
And from an international perspective, I recommended that no international agency participate in more than 2 work groups, so that we could step away from the meeting of the whole,
mm-hmm.
and also because even though all of us have capabilities in every area, each of us has greater strengths in some areas than another.
Mm-hmm.
So, for example, the World Health Organization was the convener for field mobilization and support. UNICEF continued to be the convener for message and materials development. There's an organization that has longstanding in Liberia called Restoring Basic Health Services
mm-hmm.
that was the convener for training because they had extensive experience and capacity in that area. And CDC was the convener for media.
Okay.
And then we had a national NGO partnered with each so that we could do both capacity development for the ministry and capacity development for the country.
Mm.
And then we invited people to sign up for not more than 2. And Reverend Smo specified himself that the national NGOs not sign up for more than 2 because he wanted them to be able to focus as well and not use this as a broad-based training opportunity. Many of the national NGOs had sprung up in response to the Ebola outbreak. So there were long-standing national NGOs like Crusaders for Peace,
mm-hmm.
and there were also organizations that had sprung up
right.
more recently to provide help.
Mm-hmm.
So that's what we did, and it worked. It brought order to the meetings.
Mm-hmm.
The committees convened and reported, and by the time I returned in November, all of the work groups were being convened by the national NGO, with the exception of message and materials development, which was co-convened by the ministry and UNICEF. So
okay.
It was so exciting to see capacity happening right.
right
in front of your eyes.
Yeah. So if I understand it correctly, you had the social mobilization pillar, and then these were essentially 4 subcommittees that reported back to the main group. Is that right?
Right.
Okay. And so the big group, was it still 60 different people in one room for the main meeting?
It was still 60 different people in one room, but they weren't all talking at one time.
Okay.
They had basically done their business and were making recommendations, doing report outs from their meeting and making recommendations okay. and to the ministry.
And these four subgroups, they would meet every day as well? So message materials, development, media, they would meet every day?
They met at least weekly. It depended okay. on what they were doing. Message and materials development, for example, at that point, met a few times a week.
Okay.
As the field support mobilization effort was getting going, they met more frequently. So meetings were not, meet at least once a week and meet in advance of the social mobilization meeting.
Right.
But it did not restrict groups from meeting more frequently.
Right.
So it sort of depended upon the level of activity and what was really needed for that particular function.
Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's great because I would actually, when I look at all these four things, I'm interested in all four of them. But maybe if we take the message and materials development one first, the feeling that I get from talking to people here is that initially there was a lot of criticism of some of the messages that had come out. They were very fatalistic, Ebola kills, and people didn't really know how to respond to that, or, you know, frankly, why would you respond if you're going to die anyway? So how did you see this message and materials development committee maybe improving the content of some of the messages that were going out, not necessarily to people in the field, but to, you know, on billboards, on the radio, at the press conferences?
Right. So one of the things that we did, and let me say again, UNICEF did an extraordinary job
okay.
on the message development component. One of the reasons that messages were fatalistic early on was because there were so many people in that space, and it was not organized because there wasn't a structure.
Yeah.
So it goes back to the fundamental challenge in the country that they hadn't had to confront something like this before.
Mm-hmm.
So a structure to do that didn't exist. Accordingly, what happened in the very early going in July and August, early August, for example,
mm-hmm.
is that people were saying what they believed with the best of intention. And typically, what happens in crisis or emergency situations like this is that with the best of intentions, government officials and science officials do the wrong thing, because mm-hmm. the right thing is totally counterintuitive.
Hmm.
The IMS manager was leading with deaths every time and was
right.
not at all talking about the progress that was being made and the way that the IMS was being organized. So one of the things that we did was to work closely with UNICEF to ensure, CDC's lane is science, and so we worked closely with UNICEF, which was working on a well-developed message palette by that time, to ensure that all of the messages were based in sound science. And
mm-hmm.
we made some, throughout the response, we would provide input and suggest modifications to messages based on science.
Okay.
But by early September, UNICEF had traction. However, it's difficult to overcome the first things that people hear. You know,
right.
the first person out of the gate is the person who sort of sets the standard, and after that, everybody else is playing catch up.
Mm-hmm.
And that's exactly what was occurring in Liberia. And then when you had so many organizations involved and trying to influence the message development, it was really difficult for the team at UNICEF to be able to make substantive progress or to be able to move the dial as readily
mm-hmm.
As might have been desirable, because it was just the organization to support them was not there.
Right.
And so what we did, the other thing that we did at the IMS level with the IMS manager and at the ministry level with the Minister of Information was we established what I would call a risk communication frame. And so we looked at the four primary models of risk communication that were established or codified in the early 2000s by Peter Sandman and Vince Covello.
Mm-hmm.
And looked at the practical applications. There are ways that you can counter each of those types of public reactions with a communication method. And so, for example, we began to talk about the process, about what the ministry was doing, and we didn't delete how many people had died, but we talked about what we we were doing to bridge the gap.
Uh-huh.
We talked about what we didn't know. The IMS manager was an astute pupil, I would say, of risk communication, mm-hmm. an astute learner. And as a result, he quickly understood the value and adopted what we would call anticipatory guidance, which meant that he would be saying to people, when something good happened, this is encouraging, and this is going to take a long time. You know,
mm-hmm.
we are in this for the long haul. We anticipate that it could get worse before it gets better. And he began saying those sorts of things. So we also built on the cultural, and we switched messages from negative to positive. That was another
right.
very deliberate step that we did. You know, I did some rapid sort of trending research, you know, not in-depth formative
mm-hmm.
research, but rapid formative research to ask questions of Liberians about, you know, what kind of messages do you all like to hear? Do you, you know, do you respond better to messages that provide warnings,
mm-hmm.
or do you respond better to messages that tell you what to do? Uniformly, people said that essentially they responded better to positive messages.
Mm-hmm.
So we just switched the frame from negative to positive. Rather than telling people what not to do, we told them what to do.
Mm-hmm.
Or if we were telling them what not to do, then we gave them the corollary of what should they do. Because if you give people only the negative, you leave a gap
yeah.
that your audience then has to fill on its own. And
yeah.
they may or may not fill it with what you think they should.
Huh.
But, you know, if you don't tell them what to do or make a recommendation, then they're going to fill it to the best of their ability.
Right.
And so, you know, those were risk communication components that we put in place. We also looked at, it's not more recent research, but it's being more recently folded into RISCOM, and it was extraordinarily important in West Africa. We had to look at the cultural frame.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm really hammering on here, but the best, the majority of research in risk communication has taken place in the United States and the European Union. Developing nations do not have the same paradigms
mm-hmm.
nor the same technology as G7 nations. And so we had to look at the cultural component. We had also to consider very deliberately the fact that the country was only a decade out of 15 years of devastating civil war.
Mm-hmm.
And so much of our messaging looked at the cultural importance of talking about how united we could do this, together we could participate.
Interesting.
And that set up, you know, that set up the campaign, which happened in the second deployment. But
uh-huh.
we started establishing that that foundation, that government and the people were in this together. And by describing what government was doing, we were showing action. And then by telling people, giving people recommendations about appropriate actions to take, we were giving them a way to intersect with the overall response, even when we still didn't have enough beds, enough ambulances, or
right.
enough ways to get people to treatment. So, you know, that was a very deliberate approach. So making sure there was a scientific foundation that was very credible, switching from negative to positive framing,
mm-hmm.
And looking at the cultural considerations would be, you know, three examples.
Yeah. No, I mean, that's very, very useful. And I want to take it right from there to go to media in the sense, so I want to ask a separate question about field mobilization later, but on media, could you just describe a little bit like how it worked practically with the press conferences from the Ministry of Information? So you mentioned the joint committee that had been set up, but kind of day to day, how would that work when it started getting better? And maybe just one or two thoughts on other mediums like the radio, for example, that played a big role.
Sure. So the let me just gather thoughts here for a second.
Sure.
The way that the Ministry of Information was operating initially, in order to be able to have a information flowing to the media and sense to other avenues into community radio, for example, was to conduct a daily news conference. The daily news conference was scheduled for 11 o'clock every day. The IMS meeting did not end until 11 o'clock. So essentially, immediately after the IMS meeting, first AGI and then myself in partnership with AGI and then I was knocking out five or six what we called press lines for the minister, for the incident commander, and he raced across town, arriving late every time to the news conference with these five or six lines in hand. And before I got there, it pretty much led with how many people had died today.
And
so we changed the approach to his messaging and began to give him information about process, you know, what the IMS had done that day. And then the second thing that we did was to work with the Minister of Information and the IMS manager and proposed a alternative structure for the news conferences, which would provide the IMS commander the opportunity to evaluate and analyze his information, and also to provide the country an opportunity to focus on something besides people dying and besides the epidemic itself. And so what I recommended to both was that we change the news conference structure to three times a week.
Okay.
And on the they would be Monday, Wednesday, and Friday for health focus. And on Monday, that would allow the IMS manager or the ministry representative to report on what had happened in the Friday IMS meeting. On Wednesday, they reported what had happened in the Monday meeting. And on Friday, they reported what had happened in the Wednesday meeting. So there was an opportunity to look at information as it was coming in, make some decisions about it, and be more deliberate about sharing. And then we looked at how the information was framed and what kinds of information we were providing. At the same time, we provided a three times a week bulletin called the Ebola Update to all partners and to the Minister of Information, so that everybody had the same two-page summary to use, and all of those messages were constructed with a risk communication frame.
Okay.
We then incorporated more spokespersons, so the incident commander did not have to be the only person who spoke. And we began, as we were talking about process information, to incorporate other task force leaders as the spokespersons for the news conferences. So if we were talking about case management, for example, you know, Dr. Kate or Dr. Fala would be the person who would speak about that. If we were talking about health promotion, Reverend Smo would make the presentation. And the way Liberian news conferences work, there's typically a formal presentation, and then, you know, then there are very orderly questions from the people in attendance. We also ensured that there was a partner present for each area that we were discussing. So, for example, if we were discussing case management, then the partner that was most active in that particular part of the response was also present to be able to, you know, give a partner perspective and show that there was a lot of collaboration happening. And that also allowed the media to essentially triangulate their information. They could hear from the ministry, they could hear from the people, they could hear from a partner, and then they could assess that and perhaps report more broadly. And so that, over time, worked well. At the point that I left in December, I suggested to the person who followed me that it might be time to switch the health conferences from 3 days a week to 2 days a week. And then in the other 2 days during the period that I was there, the ministry could invite other parts of government to, you know, to report on what they were doing. And so it allowed the opportunity for media to report or to reflect some sort of normalization mm-hmm. in government operations, and you know, to be able to you know, vary the kind of information that was going out.
Right.
So the entire focus was no longer on how many people died the day before.
Yeah, yeah. And how about the radio specifically, or other mediums that this information would then maybe go on to? But I have a sense that the radio is at least worth mentioning in this story.
Right. Radio is extraordinarily important in Liberia, and it is community radio specifically mm-hmm. is the best way, other than face-to-face communication,
right.
to get information throughout the country. So a couple of things happened there. One is there were a couple of national radio shows every week, one from the Liberian Broadcast Agency that is operated by the Ministry of Information, excuse me, and one from UNMIL, mm-hmm. The United Nations Mission in Liberia, that was a national broadcast. So immediately after, or the day following the news conference, one of the ministry officials would be the featured guest on the UNMIL program,
mm-hmm.
and one of the ministry officials would be the featured guest on the national broadcast. And then the access to community radio was, there were multiple ways of reaching community radio,
mm-hmm.
and not necessarily one consistent way other than what went out from the Ministry of Information. So UNICEF and UNMIL had ties with some community radio stations.
Mm-hmm.
IREX,
yes.
Had ties with some community radio stations. Internews, when it came in, had ties with some community radio stations. So what we did was make sure that they had those daily or three times a week Ebola updates,
huh.
so that they could incorporate those in the information that they were sending to the community radio station.
I see. Very, very interesting. So kind of just filtering it down through everyone else.
Yeah, making sure that everybody had the same foundational information to
yeah.
work from.
Yeah.
And then how they framed it, you know, we framed it in a certain way. We framed it, you know, had a risk comp frame as we were going in. But, you know, how they communicated it then incorporated the very necessary cultural approach.
Right. So these, like, dramas were being played out on the radio.
Right.
Yeah.
You know, standard English is the lingua franca, or the official language
yeah.
of Liberia. But Liberian English, which is a bona fide language but not a written language,
mm-hmm.
is more like the lingua franca.
Yeah.
And then there are 16 tribal languages. So that information could then be converted by these different agencies into the different languages. So if IREX, for example, had a tie with a community radio station where the population was primarily Kru,
mm-hmm.
they could provide the information in Kru.
I see.
And, you know, our incident commander, I asked him one time, I said, do we need to look at phrasing this in Liberian English? And he said, no, I do that as I'm reading. I said,
yeah.
Great. I thought that was the case. So he just basically translated off the cuff as he
right.
was going.
All right. Great. And I want to switch at this point then to the two remaining pillars here. So the one that you mentioned it on training, would that be training specifically for people who would go out and be social mobilizers, or what did training mean in this context?
So training involved really looking at a group of people called General Community Health Volunteers,
okay.
GCHVs,
mm-hmm.
and ensuring that they had all of the information that they needed to be able to conduct local visits, house-to-house calls, whatever might be needed.
Mm-hmm.
We also, the ministry made sure that health education people in each of the districts had consistent information, and the county health officials and district health officials had consistent information.
Mm-hmm.
All of the same information went to all of the NGOs, so that because training could be dispersed depending on who was in a particular county,
exactly, yeah.
Then, you know, they had the same materials to work with to be able to disseminate to their group.
Mm-hmm.
And in the period that I was back in the States in October, the ministry was putting into place a remarkable program called Reach Every District.
Mm-hmm.
And it was basically a social mobilization effort to ensure that every district had information. And so the week that I returned to Liberia, they were launching this program in collaboration with a number of partners, including CDC and the Carter Center,
mm-hmm.
at a meeting of the National Association of Tribal Leaders and Chiefs.
Uh-huh.
And that that helped disseminate information through the traditional government as well as through the political.
Right. I think this was like around 17th of October or something like that, right? Does that sound about right?
The red activity began in November.
Okay.
In the middle of November, and was finished by the second week of December. In that period, and the ministry put all of its personnel into the field, all of its social mobilization or promotion personnel in the field,
mm-hmm.
And they covered 77 districts in 30 days.
Wow.
They did not do Monrovia. They saved that for the second wave, which happened in December, but they covered all of the rural districts.
Okay.
And it was a remarkable effort.
Hmm. So the other, or one maybe complicating factor in the story of, and if I say social mobilization at this point, I'm just referring to people who were going door to door or in communities, is the fact that there was, in addition to the ministries, these community health volunteers, you had UNICEF training their own social mobilizers and running an operation, and you also had this ECAP program later. I don't know if that maybe happened when you were not there, but Mercy Corps had they claim that they reached 2.5 million people. Could you speak on that at all, like the fact that there were essentially three different organizations training social mobilizers? Did that create problems, or were they all basically using the same material?
ECAP occurred later, after the ministry's program, and I really had no knowledge of that because
okay.
it was implemented in the period when I was back in the States for
okay.
the most, for about 6 months. So, I really can't speak to whether it caused problems or not.
Mm-hmm.
That would need to come from Reverend Smough or somebody mm-hmm. Within the country.
And how about UNICEF's? I mean, they co-chaired the whole pillar. Did they work closely with the ministry in training social mobilizers? Did you get that sense?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Would you say they were one
yeah.
team? Like, when you're talking about Reach Every District, would that have automatically included UNICEF, for example?
Yes.
Okay.
The Reach Every District program was an effort that was spearheaded by the Ministry of Health Promotion Department.
Mm-hmm.
With support, I mean, we're talking about a lean organization.
Yeah.
Very, very small.
Yeah.
And so in order to do something like that, it was essential to have support from a broad range of NGOs.
Right.
And, I did not do the evaluation, and I don't know if evaluation has been done,
mm-hmm.
but I am hopeful that the structure that was put in place helped facilitate more orderly support
right.
for the ministry by the NGOs.
Mm-hmm.
Working with the Carter Center, for example, which was a linkage that we helped promote. Certainly they already had some of these linkages, but what we tried to do was create some structures that would strengthen them.
Yeah.
And the Carter Center was a wonderful link, along with the Ministry of the mm-hmm. Interior, I believe, to reach the traditional leaders.
Right.
So there was both an NGO outreach to traditional leaders and a government outreach to traditional leaders.
Mm-hmm.
So there was scarcely a thing that occurred in Liberia that didn't have partners engaging with the ministry, because
right.
you really needed all hands on deck.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't something that anybody, that any one partner nor the ministry could do on its own. It really took everyone.
Yeah.
And, you know, just to speak really briefly, to give you a corollary example, in the rapid isolation and treatment of Ebola strategy
mm-hmm.
that CDC helped the ministry put together, the brilliant part of that strategy was that four-person teams would go from the county health office or the district health office as soon as they received notification of a possible case, and those four-person teams could be comprised of any group of ministry and voluntary organizations that were in that area. So it could be the county health officer, MSF, International Red Cross, and CDC. It could be the district health officer, Global Communities, Save the Children, and IMS. I mean, it could be, it could be any constellation, whatever happened to be there. They had standard protocols and standard actions to take,
mm-hmm.
but the grouping could vary. And I think, that my observation would be that was fairly true in many aspects of the response.
Okay. Yeah. I guess.
It was not a case of, the ministry was always in charge,
mm-hmm.
and our job was to support them so that we could end the epidemic.
Right, right. If we could speak for a few moments on the last one here, field mobilization, I assume that refers to, the foot soldiers going out into the communities. Could you describe a little bit how that one worked?
So field mobilization and support had two components. One was training. And so the way it worked was sort of cascading. So the Message and Materials Development Committee developed the messages and the materials. The training committee used those messages and recommended specific types of training materials, working with the Message and Materials Development Work Group, and developed the training plan. And then the field mobilization and support did the implementation.
Okay, I see.
And so it was, it was a collaborative effort, and each of the work groups had a responsibility, and then the media work group, supported the link with the ministry's information so that that information could
mm-hmm.
get out broadly, and also supported the dissemination of consistent information through the partners.
Mm-hmm. But what does it mean when you say field mobilization provided support? What did that practically mean?
It could mean that, that they had people in the district as well. It could be that they were, working with the ministry to help plan the process,
mm-hmm.
how it was going to proceed, who was going to be where, it could be putting forward a stipend so that people could afford to come, finding the meeting room. So, could be a range of things.
Okay.
And the World Health Organization was the lead for that.
Hmm.
I don't know if Liliana is still in the country or not.
Hi, can you hear me still?
Okay. I was just looking for the, if I could find the, Lilian Luaga.
Okay.
L-I-L-I-A-N.
L-I-L-I-A-N?
L-I-L-I-A-N-E, sorry. Luaga, L-U-W-A-G-A, I believe, was the WHO person.
Okay. Thanks. Right, so it sounds like general support then, support services to social mobilizers out in the field. Would that be correct?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, I think that would be a reasonable statement.
Right.
And that support could take a variety of forms.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So, with all of this in place now, how did you see those initial challenges that we spoke about? How did you see the situation improving, hopefully?
So the first one was organization, and having a structure for the international and national NGOs to intersect with, to provide coherent support, if you will, to really, you know, have a good way of providing support to the ministry. And as I noted, you know, when I returned in November after only a 30-day absence from the country, the national NGOs were convening the meetings, and the social mobilization meetings were completely different. They were very orderly. There were presentations from each group. There were decisions made by the group, decisions made by the ministry, and all of the conditions were in place to be able to support that extraordinary Reach Every District effort. And, you know, I think the challenge is when, you know, as international NGOs, we are accustomed, for example, WHO, UNICEF, MSF, CDC, you know, global communities, all of us have, for example, an organizational email system. The Liberian Ministry of Health has no email system. The government of Liberia has no organized email system. And so everyone has a personal email. And so that, you know, having the ability to funnel information through specific work groups really helped the leadership be able to have a better span of control and to have a grasp of everything that was going on, but not to have to cope with messages from 60 different organizations.
Yeah, certainly.
With regard to the second piece, the messaging, Liberia has, to this day, the most sophisticated message manual of any of the three countries that were most affected by Ebola. And under the leadership, joint leadership of UNICEF and the Ministry of Health, the message manual was refined and revised and updated, and new information and systems added, or information and issues added, throughout the entire response. So today, if Ebola happens again, they have a concrete message manual to serve as a reference that, you know, is very oriented to be able to support a future response. And the messages are scientifically accurate, and they provide a positive or, you know, self-efficacy sort of personal action kind of frame.
Right. And so the big thing I'm looking at in the story, though, which we haven't really mentioned that much yet, is at the end of the day, it's about winning trust from the communities themselves, right? They have to change behaviors that are, in many cases, just normal human behaviors, and in others are more culturally influenced. So from the very broadest level, what do you think were some of the key things that actually built that trust when, as you mentioned, it was really lost in the beginning, to the point where people were eventually willing to cooperate and change those behaviors?
Personal observation, and this is my personal observation, I am not representing the opinion of the agency, I want to be very clear about that, is that the turning point occurred between the 4th and the 8th of October, when the Ministry of Health convened the National Council of Tribal Chiefs in Banga, in Bong County, for a four-day meeting. Every ministry and every workforce or work group that was part of the response was present at that meeting to brief the traditional leaders on what was happening. And out of that meeting came a 10-point resolution from the National Association of Traditional Chiefs that said that they would support the ministry and the government in this response. Building that bridge, you know, much of trust really in Liberia was bridge building.
Right.
And it's not one of those things, understandably, I believe, where you can come in and just because I'm from CDC does not automatically make me a trusted emissary.
Yeah.
It just means that I am from CDC, and they know that CDC is a partner. And so as I stated, just in my sphere of activity, it took 3 weeks to really build that trust and to demonstrate, you know, that I was responsive to the needs, that I could produce products that were useful, that I was truly there to support the ministry. And, you know, and then we were able to make really good progress. And, you know, that needed to happen in every sector. At the same time, having the, so, and then we built a bridge between the ministry, really, first between the Message Materials Development Committee and the rest of the response, to be able to move those messages into the IMS and into the partners' hands. And then we built a bridge between the Ministry of Health and the Ministry of Information, such that by the, I think it was the 19th of December, the IMS commander and the Minister of Information jointly presented to the President the Ebola Musco campaign. It was a joint activity. And so similarly, a bridge needed to be built between the political government and the traditional leadership in order to have the most effective reach into the communities. And that that supported, you know, the connection at the county and district levels, where people were well acquainted, but it sort of gave it the official mantle of the official mantle that said the entire government is in line with this. And, you know, that shortly after that meeting, the what we call the epi curve bent, and cases started to decline. You know, the crisis certainly wasn't over, but it wasn't still going up.
Right. Very, very interesting stuff. Any
and,
final?
That's my personal observation.
Right. No.
Looking at the epi curve, looking at the timing of events.
Yeah.
And the reason I believe that is because at that time we still didn't have enough ETU then.
Right.
We still didn't have enough ambulances. We still didn't have, the right system was not in place. So those structural things were still missing. But the curve still began to bend.
So I want to, maybe one last question as a devil's advocate on that exact point though. Couldn't it also just be that with the peak of the crisis just being so bad that people were just seeing so much death, and at a certain point you just it's just too much, that you maybe on your own start changing some behavior? So what do you think about the idea of this community learning essentially as part of that explanation?
That is a plausible hypothesis. Community learning needs to be supported with what are the actions.
Right.
And, you know, hand washing does not prevent Ebola.
Yeah.
So what we were asking people in West Africa to do was to change deeply held beliefs and long-standing cultural traditions.
Yeah.
It's not the same as use less salt.
Mm-hmm.
You know, consume less sugar. It's change the way that you care for your family members, whether they are ill or dead. You know, that's a profound change.
Right.
And so on one hand, yes, people could learn that. On the other hand, in terms of asking people to do something different, this was so, this was such a big ask that it needed to be, I believe, somehow supported by other methods, and whether that was information, whether it was outreach from general community health volunteers, whether it was reinforcement from the tribal leadership, I don't know. I don't believe that evaluation has been conducted, except that we do know that a large percentage of people remembered receiving a visit from a general community health volunteer.
Okay. Do you have a document maybe with some information on that?
That would have to come from the ministry.
Okay.
Because it's not my document.
Okay.
But, you know, I can tell you that was one of the findings.
Okay.
Unfortunately, the message people people most remembered was wash your hands, but, you know, nonetheless, enough change was made to be able to, change the course of events, and conceivably people could have done it on their own. My hypothesis would be that it might have taken longer than it actually did. And Dr. Frieden himself, our CDC director, said that things changed in Liberia when the community became involved. And in the period of October to middle of October to middle of December, lots of things happened. The government had enough of a structure to be able to reach the communities and have the resources for the communities to be able to use, and the people were given concrete actions through the Ebola Must Go campaign, for example, that they could take that would allow them to intersect with the structure that was there. So, you know, it was it's multifactorial.
Right. And I think my working hypothesis at this point is certainly that the point you make about, okay, even if I completely on my own decided, okay, I need to change something now, then at the very least I would have had the correct information at hand to know what to do now, actually. So even if the trigger for me changing my behavior wasn't necessarily someone showing up at my door, at the very least, getting that information and knowing what steps to take was certainly very important, because I could imagine that if someone wanted to change something and didn't know what to do, that would have been like a nightmare scenario also. So
exactly. Then what people do is they do what is prudent.
Yeah.
And I can give you an example. Early in the response, one of our people visited with a county health official who had had a report of the of a potential outbreak in a village, and you know, I just remember this vividly. She was recounting what the county health official had told her, and he said, after he left the road, he walked for 8 hours, he crossed two rivers, and when he arrived at the village, there were 22 graves, and there was no one left.
Wow.
Because the people had fled. So, fleeing is not panic. Fleeing is taking personal, prudent action to distance you and your family from an illness.
Right.
Sadly, that spread the illness.
Yeah.
But in terms of a chain of thought, you know, stay in place and tell someone was a primary message that we had to get out so that people would not flee and not take the illness with them and spread it further.
Right.
So, you know, being able to change that behavior also required, I believe, layering, if you will. So the information was going out through the traditional chiefs. The information was going out through the town criers. They were provided megaphones, so they didn't have to just shout. It could save their voices because they were doing a lot of talking. Messages went out through the community health volunteers. Those same messages were being heard on community radio.
Yeah.
Those same messages were in the newspaper. Those same messages, when we got the campaign going, were in posters and you know, on banners, and you know, being delivered by a multiplicity of different groups. So, you know, people were hearing it from a lot of different directions.
Right. Yeah. Well, that's just about an hour, so I think I will not take any more of your time, but that was really a fascinating conversation. Thank you so very much for taking the time to talk to me.
Thank you. I hope it's useful, and please give my regards to Peter if you're talking to him again.
I'll do that. So, like I mentioned, I'll send the form through to you, and then as we go along, probably within the next 3 months or so, I'll be in touch with a few quotes that we may like to use, and then you can just give your input on that.
Okay.
All right. Great. Thank you so much, and have a nice day.
All right.